Welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. And speaking of recovery, it's brought to you by our friends at Reprieve Recovery up there in Morgan, Utah. It's an all-female recovery center specializing in ladies and getting them back on their road to recovery. For more information, check them out online at ReprieveRC.com. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. This episode today is going to be different than other episodes because I'm calling this one Catching Up with Christian. A lot of you might remember Christian Smith. We're going to bring him in right now. Christian Smith, how long do you think it's been since you've been on the podcast?
I'm guessing 8 months.
8 months. I remember when you first
it's
came
way
on.
Way longer than 8 months.
No, because he came in.
Was it?
We came in originally. He invited me originally to tell my story.
Yep.
Then we came in a second time and brought daughter.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
daughter,
right.
Sarah,
okay.
Crazy
that's right.
Sarah.
All right.
And which was unique in the fact that we talked to his daughter.
That was really fun.
About his addiction and what that looked like. And because, you know, this podcast is about recovery. And we say that addiction is a family disease and so is recovery. And we want to make sure that we cover all sides of it.
You know, I spoke to somebody the other day in an unrelated situation, but they listen to the show sometimes and they said, they divulged that they have a family member who has an addiction. And they said, until I realized what was going on, I never really understood what you guys meant by addiction is a family disease. And they were like, it is so true that without everybody pitching in, it's not going to get better, but also it affects everybody.
Yeah.
And you know what that particular family member of theirs said?
What?
Just exactly what you said to everybody. This is my problem. I don't know. It doesn't affect you guys.
Yeah. What do you care? This is my body. Yeah. I'm not making you do drugs.
Exactly. But the truth is, it's wonderful when people spread the word and realize, you know, this affects everybody. So we're all in it, whether you're the addict or not.
So we're going to catch up with Christian and we're going to have an open conversation about some of the things we see going on in the recovery community. Some good, some bad, and just have an open conversation. But before we get to that, I want to share something that happened to me last Friday night. And because a lot of the time on this podcast, we focus the first 15 minutes kind of going through what I go through in my recovery. And that was kind of one of the main things we were going to do with this podcast is I was going to take you along this journey with me, the good, the bad, the ugly, and everything in between. If you'd asked me over 5.5 years ago what my sobriety looks like, I would have told you it would have been okay. The main thing I wanted was just to be sober. I had no idea that my life would be as good as it is today. The relationships that I've formed, the career paths that I've moved into, the things that are going on in my life, it is way better than I ever imagined.
Well, your mustache is pretty cool.
It is. You know, I've grown
this. You didn't have that before.
No, this wonderful mustache.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, like, I'm not going to lie. It's fun to be me. Like, I really have a good time being me. I get a front row seat to all the cool events that are going on in the state. Mm-hmm. Not only do I get a front row seat, I get invited. And when I go there, people show me their best foot, and they just open up the doors and let me act like a fool and just do all kinds of cool stuff.
Yeah, I agree. It's good to be Casey Scott.
And it's so much that it just feels really good, and I never thought I'd get this opportunity again. So the fact that I get to do it means even so much more this time. When I'm out and about and I'll go talk to groups or I'll talk to families and talk about recovery and help people through addiction and try to find that new path to recovery. And so a lot of times I'm looking at life through rose-colored glasses. Mm-hmm. And everything is just looking amazing. Mm-hmm. And so much of the fact that sometimes it's hard to believe that my past was what it was. So last Friday night, me and my girlfriend, the lovely Leslie, I didn't have my kids. She didn't have her kids. We said, let's go out to dinner. She said, great, let's go. So what would you like to eat? She said, Mexican. I said, I got a perfect place. There's this wonderful Mexican restaurant right around the corner from my house. So we get in the car, we go there. There's a little bit of a wait, but that's okay because we don't have anything to do. So we walk in the front door. And as soon as I walk in, I see a couple I know from the golf club. And I go up and I say hi to them. And we're talking back and forth and just talking shop. And then I look up to see who they're with. And the people they are with are also friends of mine or were friends of mine. Mm. I'm not sure where we stand right now. I can tell you that I grew up with these people. My mom had worked with them for years. I went to high school with their son. I played football with their son. When he got married, he asked me to be his DJ. And I was elated. And I was excited to show these people what I could do and how good I can be at this job. Unfortunately for them, the DJ they hired was in the midst of ruining his life. And this friend of mine, who put all his confidence in me and was ready to let me celebrate and kind of host his big day. We had family members flying in from different states. They had this big venue up in Park City rented out. It was an elaborate wedding. It was a wedding for the time. I mean, it was an amazing wedding.
Big deal.
Big deal. Huge deal. And the DJ they got.
And when people set up a wedding like that, they really want everything to go off perfectly, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the flowers, the tablecloths, everything.
The entry songs, yep. The first dance, the music, and right. Everything. And you think about this. A bride, for the most part, and maybe even the groom, have been dreaming about their wedding ever since they can.
Since they could pretend to be married. Yeah.
You know, and so little. This is the night. This is the night to kick off our lives for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
This is the union of two families coming together, starting a new one. And this wedding was supposed to be amazing.
Well, it's up in Park City, a big venue. Probably was pretty nice, huh?
And I'm in process of throwing my life away. Thinking that I was in control, I was cocky, I was smug, I was belligerent, I was disrespectful, I was embarrassing. I did everything wrong. Mm. And we didn't even talk about the wedding when I saw these people. But my girlfriend saw my attitude change as soon as I saw those people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all sitting there in the lobby, and they call that foursome to go in to sit down. And so I have time to talk to my girlfriend. I go, they do not like me, and I do not blame them. And I told her a little bit about the situation. And mm-hmm. She goes, well, hopefully they see you're doing well. I go, I don't know if that matters. She goes, well, hopefully we don't get sit next to them.
And so?
We sat next to them. So we walk into the restaurant.
Karma, man.
And there are four tops right there, and we're sitting right next to them.
Yeah.
And
that's where you tip the hostess, you know, $20. Let's sit somewhere else.
But in my head, I was like, I don't want to run from this, because I felt like in my head, if I would have came in and I would have done that.
Yeah.
Then it seems like I'm running from them, and I don't want to run from them.
No, I get it. I'm just joking. That's not your style. But like,
that wasn't my thought process. I'm not kidding you.
It would have been in mine.
How can I get away from this? But then I also said, but wait a minute.
So you haven't talked to them since this wedding fiasco.
After the wedding, I woke up and remembered all that I had done. Embarrassed and ashamed, I got to work, and I made phone calls. I sent emails, I sent texts, apologizing for my behavior. But I mean, the damage had already been done.
Sure.
You know.
But you, when you sobered up, literally, you realized, holy cow, I blew it.
I can't believe I did this.
Yeah.
And this is embarrassing for me, for my family, for my parents, for them. The people at the wedding were people I went to high school with.
So,
you know, and a lot of people that I had seen for 20 years that were going to see me for the first time. And this is the person they saw. Mm. And I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that I was at my lowest. I was at my worst, my most embarrassing. I am shocked. I mean, it was one of those things when I saw them, it instantaneously hit me. And I was like, oh, my gosh. And I relived that whole night.
Mm.
So uncomfortable, the fact that I did not even sleep that night. And my girlfriend was like, well, what was wrong with you last night? And I was like, I just couldn't get it out of my head. Now, I know I'm
far... Did you guys have any conversation back and forth at the tables during dinner?
I talked to the other couple, but I
and
said...
And they never responded to your original apologies from back in the day?
I don't believe so.
Yeah.
And I did say hi to them, and they said hi back.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, and I know there's nothing I can do to change that. And I know that I can't live in that space. But I do have to acknowledge that space. Mm-hmm. And I do have to accept that there's people out there that have seen me at my worst and do not forgive me and do not want me in their lives. And that's okay. And I'm okay with that. But it still hurts.
Sure.
It still saddens me that I had a chance to give these guys something special and I gave them the exact opposite. I ruined it. I did everything in my power. So we're sitting there, and I didn't know what to do. So I did talk to the waitress. I said, can we get our bill? And while you're at it, can I get their bill too? And she goes, sure. And so she gave it to me. And my girlfriend's like, what are you doing? I go, I'm going to buy them dinner. And when I say I'm going to buy him dinner, that was not going to make up for it in any means.
But you're making a gesture.
I just wanted them to know that, hey, look, I know this will never make it right. I know this will never fix it. And if I don't hear from you, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, but I need you to know that this is some small way of me saying I'm sorry and I still remember and I feel horrible.
Yeah.
And so I bought their dinner and... it made me feel a little bit better, but I wasn't sure how it was going to be received.
Well, it sounded like it kept you up at night still.
It did keep me up at night. And so the next day I'm getting ready and the phone rings and it's an unknown number. And I'd answer it anyways because I like talking to telemarketers.
We're a little different, I think, sometimes, Casey.
So I pick it up and it's not the couple who's... son's wedding I ruined. It was the other couple.
Okay.
And he just wanted to say, hey, thank you. That was a very nice gesture. We really appreciate you doing that. And the guy even made a joke. He goes, had we known you were going to do that, we'd have ordered more.
Yeah.
And I go, I get that.
We'd have got dessert.
Yeah. And so it made me feel better. So I know that, you know, at least half, and I'm sure that it was appreciated on both sides.
Sure.
But the thing that bothers me is that, you know, that there's instances in my past that I can't make up for.
Yeah.
And I can't right those wrongs because the time has come and gone and the thing happened and it is what it is. And so I feel bad because this couple, every wedding anniversary, I imagine that my friend's wife is like, hey, remember when your friend ruined our wedding? You know what I mean? Or like, I imagine him like, hey, I think we should go here. He's like, I don't think you get to make decisions. Remember when your friend ruined our wedding? You know what I mean? Those kind of things.
She's got a permanent hand up on him.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like, and I'm the joke in this, you know.
Well, maybe, but now you're supposing. You don't know if that's true.
I don't. And I don't know if these people hate me.
Well, they were a little cool when they saw you, and so they're probably harboring some feelings still, but
yeah.
Hatred's probably a little heavy.
No,
I hope for their sake it's not hatred.
But then I didn't give them a reason to like me either.
No, I get it. And I think what you're saying is like, we can't make up for all the damage we do in life, right?
No.
And when a person's deep in their addiction, they hurt a lot of other people. And that can't always be fixed. And to some degree, we rely on other people's forgiveness, and they may not always be ready to offer it.
You know, there's been a couple of times in my recovery that I've been doing well, and I'll be out in social settings and talk to somebody, and somebody will mention my name, and or my friends will be in social situations, and somebody will mention my name, and they go, that guy's a jerk. That guy ruined my wedding. That guy thinks he's this, you know. And my friends will do what they can. They go, well, he's sober now, and he's doing the best he can. But I get that. But there's people out there that have a bad taste in their mouth about me, and rightfully so, because I did not give him the best me possible. And that hurts. And I still try to – I don't know how to navigate that world. I know that I can't go back and change it.
Well, you can't go back and change it, so what can you do?
Well, I can just keep trying to be the best me possible and keep moving forward. And hopefully don't have any other of those interactions with other people. And if I do get a chance to see those people, apologize profusely. And
I think the apology is also in your daily behavior in a way, right? Because the truth is that's a lesson for their side and your side. You know, people change, they grow, they move on. Sometimes it's for the better, sometimes it's for the worse. What we do know in psychology is people who overfocus on their past have higher rates of regret and depression than the rest of us. And that's typically because we can't do anything about that in the past. So what I recommend is a person, if they're regretting something from their past, they acknowledge it and then they ask themselves, is there anything I can do about that in the present? Can I bring that into the present some way? Sometimes we owe someone an apology and it makes sense. I don't think we owe people apologies over and over and over again. If it's sincere, I think one is sufficient. But most of the time we have to say, no, there's really not anything other than an apology I can do in the present except for continue to be my best self. And they may come along someday and feel feelings of forgiveness for you, or they may not. But at this point, that's their stuff to deal with, right? Your stuff to deal with is to say, you know what? All the new people that are going to meet Casey Scott in my lifetime, they're going to have a positive impression. He's never going to ruin another wedding. He's going to always be the guy who says what he means and means what he says, and he's going to be honest and straightforward and act with integrity. And the truth is, I think whether you're a person in recovery or not, that applies to all of us because we've all done things that we're not proud of. We've mistreated people. We've hurt people. We've let people down. And all you can do when you're perseverating on those past experiences is ask yourself, wait a second, is there anything I can do about that in the present? If there is, I'm going to get busy doing it. If there isn't, I'm going to get busy being the best self I can be.
I love that. Christian, you've been sober how many years now?
15.
Do you ever have an experience like that?
Yes.
And how do you handle it? What do you do?
I'm working on, as you were sharing that experience, years ago I was introduced to the concept of approval addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking in my mind of that's something that I struggle with. And to this day, I still struggle with, you know, I can't like me if others don't like me. And very similar stories over 27 years of drinking and drugging. I offended a lot of people. And I'm working. Somebody once said to me, Jesus had enemies and Hitler had friends. And their attempt was to say, get over yourself, Smith. Not everybody's going to like you. If that's your expectation, you're going to be setting yourself up for a lot of rejection and pain. What were we going to say?
Well, I'm going to say, I get that. And I know that not everybody out there is going to like Casey Scott. And I am not everybody's cup of tea. The problem I have is that I ruined their wedding. And I gave them a reason. It's not because they didn't like my personality. They didn't like who I was. I ruined their event because I was a selfish a-hole.
Has their 10-year reunion come up yet? Or reunion anniversary?
I don't know.
10-year anniversary? Has it been 10 years?
I don't know. Probably.
Are they still married?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What if you change the narrative? What if they actually sometime, maybe now even, or down the road with kids or grandkids? You remember our wedding? Remember that doofus dude? Well, what if it's not pain and now it's humor?
Yeah, it could be that. Absolutely. So we have to make sure we're not, you know, assuming things that we don't know are true. But my thought was, what if you called them up and said, at your next anniversary, I'm going to DJ an anniversary party for you guys?
I think they would pass, but I would.
Well, see, even that, you're just guessing.
You don't know.
That's a guess.
Well, I want you to think about that. Not because you owe that to them per se, but you're obviously, I have never really seen you like this, harboring something like this. That's not Casey Scott. So to me, you have some work to process to work that through. And buying dinners may be a nice start, right? But if you went back to the couple and you said, listen, I owe you guys a really great night. And I can't make up for what happened, but in the spirit of moving forward at your next anniversary, what if I go to the golf club and I DJ an anniversary party on me for you guys?
That's not a bad
idea. Will you think about it?
I'll think about it.
Because I'd love to be there.
Yeah.
And support you in that.
I'm in. I've known you for quite a few years, you guys correct me, Dr. Matt, and you, Casey, if I'm wrong here, but as you shared that experience, there was a lot of emotion.
Yeah.
A lot of
emotion. It's not the typical Casey Scott.
Yeah.
Because
it's an unresolved issue.
Yeah.
And I love what you're saying about like approval addiction. I haven't actually heard the term that way before, but I think I'll put myself in there. All three of us struggle with that a little bit.
100%.
Right? And it's even though in your mind, you can wrap your mind around the fact that obviously not everyone's going to like me, but maybe they could, right? Like yeah, a little bit in there, like, yeah, I want them to. So not to feed that part of your brain, but maybe to say, I've done all I can. And wouldn't it be great if for their sake and yours, it was a positive reunion?
So in my head, the way I get around what you just said is I don't need to be liked by everybody. But I want to be liked by everybody. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I understand.
I know that feeling.
I understand that, you know what I mean, that I don't need it and my day's going to go on whether it does or does not happen. But, oh, I want to be liked by everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, I really want to be liked.
Well, try being a therapist to teenagers. that'll toughen you up real quick.
Well, so we're just getting ready to kick off the show. We're catching up with Christian. You're listening to Project Recovery. Stick around. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. Our guest today is Christian Smith, who at one time held the swear record on the podcast. We've had a few people on here that have surpassed you, not by much. I remember you sitting down, Christian, and saying, hey, I come from a good LDS family. I'm going to do the best not to swear, and then swore like a sailor the whole time.
You sure have a lot of judgment, and damn it. Damn it, it offends me.
You know, but for a guy I've looked up to my whole recovery, a lot of you guys don't know this, but he was one of the first people I met when I started marketing for Pinnacle Recovery where I went. And so we'd get these get-togethers and with other recovery houses so you could swap clients. So if you get somebody who's not in network with you and they've got someone else's, you refer
finding them a better fit for people,
a better
right?
fit yeah, and, yeah. and doing that. So we once a week or once a month, we'd all get together. And I remember walking in and talking to Christian, and I was like, that's my guy.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
That you know, I vibe with him. And so when we started the podcast and he came on, it was just a wonderful chance to get to know more about you and hear your story. And your story is crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and I don't want to speak out of school, but at one point in your addiction, you took money from your son who saved up for a car.
Yes.
Went to go down and buy that car. But ended up on a 3-day bender in Wendover.
That's correct.
Am I right on that
Absolutely.
One?
Absolutely. Correct.
And so you've done some stuff that you're embarrassed of, and you've now got 15 years of sobriety. Do those kind of events rear their head at you and remind you of your past every so often? And how do you deal with that?
They don't rear it as much now as they used to, but it comes up every once in a while. Just 2 Christmases ago. We're at the family party, and my sister, who I had stolen from her many years ago, 15 plus years ago, it's getting late in the evening, and it's time for her to go, and she announces that she's going, and has anybody seen her purse, she said. And a brother of mine spoke loudly and said, has anybody seen Christian? Now, 15 years ago, that would have hurt, right? Because it was true. All those things happen. But at this point, crisis plus time has equaled humor in the family dynamic, and we laugh a lot about it. You know, as I heard your story about the dinner and the Mexican restaurant and the wedding, you know, I related all too closely with too many events in our lives where that happened. And the struggle it is to work through that. I've tried to work so that I know I'm not going to please everybody, but I want to, like you just said a minute ago. I know not everybody's going to like me, but I wish they would, or I want them to. I know I'm not going to please everybody or make amends to everybody, but I would like that to happen. What I don't want is to live my life so that when I'm walking down the street and I see somebody who I crossed years ago, that before they see me, I don't want to be in this position where I feel like I have to go to the other side of the street and kind of avoid them.
You want to walk around and hold your head high?
Yeah, I do. I want to. By the way, you said something earlier that I want to talk about. early on in the first portion there, you talked about it's good to be Casey.
Mm-hmm.
And some people might interpret that, oh, he's kind of cocky a little bit. What I think I heard you say, because I'm thinking, I like who I am right now. And what that is I am authentic. You are authentic. We see each other quite often. You are not pretentious. What you see with you is what you get today. You are honest. You live your life integrous and accountable and authentic. And I think that's all I'm shooting for.
You know, there was years that it wasn't good to be Casey, and it was miserable, and it was lonely, and it was all things that I did to myself.
I think people have a hard time with that, though, because you are a public figure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Christian and I know you in a different way. And I agree with what you just said. It wasn't always good to be Casey. And I think that might be one of the challenges you have socially that the rest of us don't, not being public figures, is that people have always probably looked at your external public self and thought, oh, it must be fun to have that job, to be a DJ on the radio, to be on TV, to be traveling around the state and doing all these fun, crazy things. So I think it's sometimes hard for people to absorb the fact that there were a lot of years there where every night was pretty tough for you.
I remember talking to my brother once, my older brother Yancey, and talking about, you know, me doing these things. And he goes, and this is when I realized what a family disease it was. He was like, you don't know, huh? And I go, what are you talking about? And he goes, do you know how many times my phone rings and people want to know what you did? And how come? And when you messed up, he's like, people would just, you know.
Go to him.
Yeah, it wasn't fun being your brother.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and you know, you and I are from similar places. I'm from Morgan. You're from South Ogden. That's small community, South Ogden. If, you know, if you're anybody, everybody knows you. And so the word got around, I know.
And so, I mean, it's just, and these are just things that I think of and that happen in my day-to-day life. And I want to share those. And that sounds like Christian can relate. And there's probably other addicts that can relate. And there's family members that relate. And I mean, I know there was times when my mom and my dad and my ex-wife and my kids, you know, all the narrative that was going around the town was that I'm this loser alcoholic. And you know what I mean? And that can't be fun for them to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And it was tough, you know, and my kids got to go to dances and kids can be mean. I still remember that time that I picked up my son from elementary school and he's out front crying. And I go, what's wrong, bud? And he goes, these kids just stood around me. He goes, your dad's an alcoholic. Your dad's an alcoholic,
yeah,
you know.
That's and heartbreaking.
The fact that my son had to go through that because of me breaks my heart,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so that's what I try to do every day is put my best foot forward so my kids don't have to answer for my mistakes. That is something that my kids should never have to do is answer for my mistakes.
Yeah.
And
but it is a family disease.
Yeah.
And that's part of being part of the family, the good and the bad.
And so, I mean, it is what it is. But I don't want to talk about me anymore. I want to talk about what's going on in the recovery community. So I thought I'd bring in Christian. And you've been in the recovery community for 15 years. You've owned recovery centers. You
yes.
work for a recovery center. You're very vigilant out there in the recovery community world. And I think you're an elderman when it comes to recovery, where people look to you for advice because you've been in it so long.
That's fair.
So what are some of the things that you're seeing out there that are, when we talked off air, you were like, let's open up some conversation. Let's push some buttons. So what's something that
And I'm excited to talk about this today because instead of having Christian review his story, which, you know, we've had the benefit of having Christian on and then Christian and his daughter on. But Christian is now in a different role on the show as a person with experience and insight into the recovery world. And a lot of people don't know what that's like.
So you said elderman. Is that what you called me?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty big vocab word, Casey.
Yeah, man,
good
was,
job.
Yeah,
I like that.
Really
well done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was almost wanted to take offense to it because I am in my 64th year. But many, you know, 27 years of field research, that's code for those that are listening that don't know.
Field research,
me drinking and drugging, and 15 years of a new way of living that we call recovery. And working in the field, I have here's some stuff that's going on in my mind as I get ready to maybe go play more golf with kids and boat with grandkids and whatnot. Here's some things going on in my mind. Our outcomes as a community, the outcomes They suck. Can I say suck on here? Is that bad?
Yeah, yeah, you can.
I feel
you
like
can
that's edit. Appropriate.
No, suck's fine.
Okay. You don't want to swear or anything. But the outcomes suck. And I know that... Well, let's talk about outcomes. Let me just talk about that for a minute.
And it's a perfect time because last week we talked about a friend of the program named Seneca. And that was kind of our jumping off point is that we were saying, you know, we're a podcast that celebrates recovery. But the reality is more people are losing this battle than winning this battle.
Yeah. Fentanyl has changed the game. That's new. That the current fentanyl out there is it's changing the game. People are dying from it. We don't even have the bad fentanyl in Utah yet. Our fentanyl doesn't have that other ingredient that I forget. If I had my mind all about me and was younger, I'd remember. Fentanyl's killing people. It's also much worse withdrawing from fentanyl than traditional opiates have been, including heroin.
That's the first time I've heard this. So I didn't know that withdrawals were worse from fentanyl than from opioids.
Well, I think that's
heroin.
Because of the synthetic nature of it, right?
Instead of it being,
it's engineered to be more addictive.
Yeah, and it's because the withdrawals are so horrific, people are not seeking, they're not seeking treatment as much. They can't get Suboxone or Subutex doesn't work as effective on the current fentanyl as it was working on other opiates.
Because we've had many people on this podcast who said that they welcomed death but feared withdrawal.
Yeah.
Is that death was something that they would welcome, and they because the withdrawals were so horrible.
Yeah, you felt like you wanted to die. You wouldn't die. You just wished you would. That's how bad it was. The feelings of you know, people ask me that question all the time. What's it like that I've never gone through it? Family members, and the closest I've ever come, and I don't think I'm doing it justice, is to take the worst flu you've ever had, and times it by 10. And I still don't think that gives an adequate explanation as to what physically and physiologically and emotionally is going on in the mind and the body.
So when talking about outcomes in recovery, you said that we're not doing good.
So, okay, Doc, you can help me with this a little bit. As I've done research over the years, I'll read a little bit and like to see what's going on there. Let's start with this. What's your understanding, Doc Matt, of how many episodes of treatment typically it requires in this country before somebody finds long-term recovery? Long-term recovery in the research I've looked at doesn't exceed 365 days, doesn't exceed a year. How many episodes do you know what the literature is saying?
Well, that's a good question. From what I've read, it's anywhere between 3 and 7. But
yeah.
You tell me.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Seven yeah. is the number that I see. It's 3 on occasion, but 7 is a number, depending on age and all that.
3 to 7 treatments or 3 to 7?
Relapses.
3 to 7 treatment episodes.
Yeah, so that means there's a relapse in between.
Yeah. So we're somatic, same thing there. And I've asked myself, you know, why is that? And many times clinicians will say to me, well, it's the addict's fault. They didn't want it bad enough. And there's probably some truth to that. But we're using...
It's a little blamey though, right?
Yeah. And I think we haven't had the modalities used to treat it. Haven't changed a lot since I've been in the business. The newest modality that I'm familiar with treating trauma is EMDR, but EMDR has been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been thinking, what is it? What can we do to increase our outcomes? Because if this was a medical procedure, we wouldn't be allowed to do it.
Right. That's too many fails.
You and I talked about airplanes, didn't mm-hmm. we? If
70% of the planes were crashing, that airline would go out of business.
Yeah.
You know, if your tagline was 30% of you will get there, fly Recovery Airways.
We're all renting cars.
So that takes this, that's how many episodes, and the outcomes, the high end I've seen is 14%.
Mm-hmm.
14% of people that do traditional.
Successfully.
Successful. Again, success being recovery or sobriety for a year. I don't think they can measure much longer.
There are
that.
Some longer term studies, but the numbers don't get better in longer term studies.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So those are our outcomes. Lots of episodes. It's expensive as all get out to do it. It's financially taxing on the family, thus breeding more resentment within the family dynamic to the person struggling with the addiction or alcoholism. And then if they do get into treatment and it's 7th time the outcome, you know, 14%. And so I'm thinking, what can we do as a community to improve those outcomes, knowing that the the agency of a given client. They get to decide. They get to decide what motivates them to come in, what their willingness is. And sometimes maybe it's just 7 treatment episodes is what it took for you to burn every bridge you've ever had in your life. And finally, there's nowhere else to go but
kind of creating a rock bottom, so
to
speak.
So, yeah.
So Casey's situation is unique because you've only been once to treatment, and thankfully you're still in sobriety.
Never relapsed.
Haven't relapsed. How many has it been for you, Christian?
I did three. And I know there's people listening to this podcast who are so frustrated with their own personal family dynamic because they've got a son or a daughter or a husband or a spouse or a sibling who's on number 13.
Sure.
And comes to them and goes, this time for sure, I really want to go back to treatment again, this time for sure. And they have to ask themselves, you know, how do we support this? Because the evidence previously has shown it's not going to work. And I'm trying to come to a place, and I would love your guys' opinion, of where does a family member go at that crossroads?
I have a couple thoughts, a couple theories. One is, why is rehab so expensive? Why is treatment so expensive? I mean, and that's just a genuine question. I don't know. And if so, then who should, you know, I mean, because there's families out there that can pay it. There's families who can't pay it. And are they getting the same quality service? Are they getting the same things? And so I think what it goes back to me and why my sobriety, I think, is working as well as it is right now is it's my willingness. And it's trying to find that person's willingness to find that sobriety. We've had so many people that have been on the podcast that are good at the treatment game, that they know if they go and do treatment, then they've got another 9 months before they have to come together again and figure that part out. So it's kind of a part of their program, if you will.
The insurance, on that note, the insurance companies are changing the game a little bit now. They've not wanted to authorize, you know, because of outcomes, right? And it makes perfect financial sense. Fiscally, if our outcomes are this bad, we don't want to authorize somebody going to treatment. There's no profit in it for the insurance companies. But there are some insurance companies right now who are putting caps on stays. I'm sure how they're doing it, but there's one right now that says if we will not authorize more than 3 treatment stays in a 12-month period.
Really?
Which is helping.
But that's not new in healthcare. And in mental health especially, they will cap things like you can have 6 therapy visits if you have something like obsessive compulsive disorder, which is a chronic issue. So, I mean, them capping it is an unfortunate thing that's happening, but that's not a surprise to me.
And it might not be unfortunate.
Why do you say that?
Because it might be to that person that you just described that's been to treatment multiple times and sees it as a, hey, I can go back to treatment, maybe get 9 months, I think is what you said. And then when it goes bad again, I'll go back. So I'm not sure it's a bad thing. It's problematic for business.
So what you're saying is if the person knows this is your last chance, then it might sober them up, so to speak.
What about motivate them? Improve their motivation so that their willingness to change.
I don't know. I love your optimism. Yeah, I love it. I just don't know if that's how it works. But I mean, I guess we should track those insurance companies and see if they change the bar a little bit. But I would be surprised.
Here's the thing with me and recovery. We say it on the podcast all the time. There's 100 different ways up recovery mountain. You got to find the one that makes sense to you and that will work for you. And so I think it needs to go back and how do we do that? How do we get somebody who's ready for recovery? How do you know, like Odyssey House, Wasatch Recovery, Pinnacle Recovery, Brighton Recovery, Reprieve, all of these places will work if you want them to. All of these recovery places will work. I always go back to the dumbest thing, but when Rocky beat the Russian, he trained up in the woods.
Drago.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he didn't have any of the fancy stuff that Ivan had. He just had the nuts and bolts and the will to win and the will to want it. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's when anybody asks, well, how do you get sober? I go, do you want it?
So motivational interviewing is a type of therapy that was developed for that exact question in addiction. That's where it came from, is trying to help motivate people to find that switch within themselves to own the change that they want to see take place. And in therapy, that's a very useful tool, because if I had a conversation last night with a couple and they were wanting me to give them the solution for them to fix the issue that they were in for, and I have great solutions, and so many good solutions.
Yeah.
But guess whose they are?
Yours.
They're mine. And so it's not that I'm withholding information, but you have to help prepare people so that they choose and they own it. It goes all the way back to Socrates, the Socratic method. Are we able to use questions to help people find the answers for themselves? So I would say, in part, psychotherapy might be part of the solution to helping a person prepare, not just recover, but prepare to benefit from recovery. And I think that that goes, like, we're talking about, like, I like your analogy. I've said it a lot myself. There's 100 different ways up sore mount. Maybe the problem with that, though, is that we actually need lots of different modalities operating all at once, because mm-hmm. what we know, and Christian, you see this in working with addicts all the time, there's a lot of different reasons why a person is in there and struggling with their addiction. And so if we don't understand those, we're being naive. We're sort of saying, hey, do this 12-step program, or do this ice bath program, or do this whatever program, and that will help fix you and keep you sober. But do we really understand why they're an addict in the first place?
Remember the guy we had on the podcast who was in prison for auto theft? And he goes, I'm in prison for auto theft, and stealing cars isn't my problem. I'm a heroin addict.
Yeah.
He goes,
right.
But I'm in here, and they're making me do all stuff for auto theft, and I'm a heroin addict.
But extrapolate that one level further. He's not even a heroin addict. He clearly struggles with heroin, but that's still a symptom. And if people that are listening to your radio show, the drugs and the alcohol, those are not the problem. They're problematic,
yeah,
but they're not at the core of the problem. And a good treatment regime would include finding out what hurts so bad at the core.
Where did it come from before the addiction started?
I remember sitting in Pinnacle Recovery, and my counselor goes, hey, you want me to blow your mind? And I was like, yeah. He goes, drinking's not your problem. I was like, I'm pretty sure drinking's my problem. That's why I'm here. He goes, no, your problems are your problems, and drinking was your solution. Now it's become problematic. But until you want to unpack that backpack and figure out why you're doing what you're doing, then you're probably not going to get better. And so I think that's 100% it, is that, you know, so many times in the elder generation, they blamed the alcohol, they blamed the drugs, and they blamed all these stuff. And yeah, it does become a problem, and the addiction is a disease and all that other stuff. But until we get down to that root cause of why you're doing it, yeah, it's not going to take.
Under most stressful situations, that neural pathway is going to be lit up again, and you're going to go back to revert to that coping mechanism.
We've on the show over the last 4.5 years, we've had people talk about their anxiety that was never treated, their trauma and traumatic experiences, their other mental health issues. There are so many different reasons why we self-medicate. And in the state of Utah, we have every type of addiction, but we specialize in a few. I would say sugar and caffeine. That's mm-hmm. one we specialize in, with all the drive-thrus and the soda pop shops and all those kinds of things.
Pornography.
Pornography is another one we specialize in, unfortunately. And if you think those aren't powerful addictions, then you don't really understand what addictions are. I recall the first time I ever worked with a food addict. And this person was spending upwards of $300 per day on drive-thrus. Now, that sounds like you're doing coke or heroin. Like, that's an expensive, and it was in many ways just as damaging emotionally and physically to the person as doing a street drug. So there are reasons why a person may choose cheeseburgers or pornography over heroin, but the underlying problems have to be identified and addressed, I think, for a person to really benefit from a treatment program.
Which takes me to the treatment programs. There's a lot of them in this state and across the country. And I think the job for a family member or someone struggling with addiction or alcoholism seeking help, their job is to go tour treatment centers until they find one. That everybody uses the same modalities in this country. The laws require it. Nobody has any proprietary stuff for treating alcoholism and addiction. But I think the cultures are different. And some modalities that are incorporated in some treatment programs are not used in another. We talked before the show, AA is a phenomenal support group for millions. And yet its numbers, outcomes are horrific. If you treated trauma without EMDR or other trauma modalities, you know, it's not going to work. So I think the job is to find a treatment program that will incorporate the appropriate modalities, but that the culture that they tour, they feel it. They don't see it. They feel it. It's not what it looks like. You can go to the most inexpensive treatment center in Utah. I don't know what that is, but it's not. It's probably 10 grand a month, maybe seven. Or you can go spend $70,000 up Provo Canyon. And you can spend 70 and not find recovery, or you can spend seven and find it. It doesn't matter so much of where you go. It's that you believe where you're going feels right, that you have a buy-in.
Well, the thing that we found on the podcast, Christian, over 4.5 years of doing this, that the opposite of addiction isn't abstinence. The opposite of addiction is connection. Yeah. And finding that connection, finding that tribe, finding that community is just as important. I remember when I was sitting up at uni detoxing and had to call my mom and have her go check a couple of rehab centers to see which one would probably most fit. And my mom went to three different ones and came back and said, you know what, I don't think this one's your style, but I think you're really going to fit in this one. And so she picked it, and she was right. It was, you know.
Second to you picking it yourself, probably not a better person on the planet than a mother who knows her kid.
But I think so many times when we have addicts in crisis, we want to take the first person that says yes. You know, it's like, I can get you in here without even doing any of the research. And I'll tell you what, we've talked about it before. We've had people on here. You should be able to call any of these recovery centers in the state, in the country, and said, tell me about your place. Tell me about your lesson plan. Tell me about your modalities. Let me do a tour. And if they don't want you, then you don't want to go there. Yeah. They should be open and honest and just forthright with all their
information.
Frankly,
proud of what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you.
What you guys are talking about is the goodness of fit model. And that's one of those general science principles. It's one of my very favorite. We've talked about it before. Success is not so much the product of individual things. It's how they fit together. And that applies to everything, whether we're talking botany or baseball or recovery. And so I think what you're saying, Christian, is help yourself, help your loved ones by trying to find the best fit, because these different centers are essentially going to offer a lot of the same things. But the culture, and like your mom was saying, Casey, this one feels like Casey. And I would imagine the others that she ruled out also had similar, if not the same, modalities and professional people and all of that. But there was something about that center that felt like the right fit for you. And in fact, it was.
So that leads me to the next one. Christian, before he came in, he called his daughter and said, I'm going to do the podcast again. And Christian asked his daughter a question. What was that question?
I told Sarah I'm going to do Casey and Matt's podcast again. And I said, what would you have me tell them? We preface it by, typically the audience that's listening to this show is listening because they may or may not have a family member or a loved one or a significant other in crisis with addiction or alcoholism. So we talked about this, you and I, Casey, just the other day. Probably not the addict, him or herself, listening to this show.
Probably not.
And so I prefaced Sarah with that background, and I said, what would you have me tell him? And her comment was, get the secret out. First thing she said, get the secret out. The secret being, okay, I have a loved one who's struggling with addiction or alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
Get that secret out. Then she went on to say, but don't tell their story. Their story is their story. Your loved one's story is their story. I think the implication was she wanted them to avoid shame.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted them. So her two big things were get the secret out. Brene Brown, I love Brene Brown as much as anybody. And then years ago, it caught the three ingredients required for shame were silence, secrecy, and judgment. So I understand the toxicity of shame, and I understand it thrives in secrecy. So she said, get the secret out, but don't tell the loved one's story. That's their story. They get to tell it.
Now, what I find so interesting about getting the secret out, and it's kind of what I do with my recovery. I put the secret out there so nobody's guessing and no one's wondering.
Yeah.
The other part about that is two. One, you can control the narrative. I'm telling it out there. This is it. And then we can have an honest conversation about it. But I don't want to tell my loved one's story because it is their story.
Right.
But the importance of getting that out there is twofold. One, it lets everybody know that you're going through, and you'll be surprised how many people are willing to help.
Oh, that want to help.
That want to help. And the other part is, most of those people already know the secret.
Yeah. It's not a secret as you think.
You know, and that was the thing me and Christian were talking about in the elevator. I was like, you know, throughout my alcoholism, I thought I was fooling everybody. Sounds like I was only fooling myself because everybody else knew.
That's the power of, I think, what your daughter was saying, is get the secret out. You unburden yourself. You own it. You let yourself realize the secret's gone, and I don't have to carry that around anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because that allows you then to start on that path of not being judgmental and just learning and understanding about yourself. I talk about that a lot in therapy, the difference between judgment and understanding. Judgment requires one of two responses, reward or punishment. Those are the only places you can go with judgment. Judgment doesn't help you understand anything. It creates a reward or a punishment. Understanding, you know, creates knowledge, and knowledge can transition into behavior change. And so when we keep things a secret, we're just judging ourselves in private, you know, and lying to ourselves. Nobody else knows. This is just my thing. You know, the minute we let it out there and make it public, we can let go. We can start that process of stopping the judgment of ourselves and of our family members and just try to understand. And that is the only prayer we have for behavior change. Does that make sense?
No,
it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's good.
Yeah.
And I never looked at judgment with a reward and that kind of consequences.
No, that's it. Those are the only two places it can go.
It's crazy. Because we all walk around.
Oh, we judge all the time. We judge ourselves. We judge other people. But I think that is a process for your life, is to learn to say to yourself, I don't want to be judgmental. I just want to be understanding. I want to learn about people. I want to learn about myself. I want to learn about dynamics. If I can understand my world and the people in it, then it opens up so many possibilities for positive behavior and change. If I'm just judging, it's rewards and punishments.
Think about this statement. Help me understand.
That's a great statement.
You know, I mean, in all situations.
If it's authentic, it's real.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to.
I mean, you know, some people will say those things and they're there to.
They're condescending.
Yeah, they're going to judge you. But if you've ever been on the receiving end of a statement like that that's truly authentic, it'll almost bring tears to your eyes, because that person, the empathy that they evoke, it's just beautiful. And that's where change happens.
You can see that happening really effective in the dynamic where the family is now in total crisis. It's the family disease. And when I say addiction, alcoholism is a family disease, I'm not implying that all members are engaging in the substance use. I'm implying that all members are feeling the effects, negative effects of the individual struggling with the substance abuse. So I'm not trying to point fingers and whatnot.
No.
Now I just lost my train of thought. Is that terrible?
The effect it has on everybody. That's what you're talking about.
Oh, shoot.
But I've got something else for you. Because you are on the front line of the recovery community, a lot of times answering the phone, talking to family members, running groups of family members inside a Wasatch Recovery. What is something that you're surprised that you still have to answer the question to when people come to you? Is there a question? Is there something, a concern that people ask? And, like, the thing is that for me, it's like, and I don't want to put my mom on blast, but she was so kind of naive. It was like, well, thank God we'll never have to do this again. And I'm like, well? And she's like, what do you mean, well? And I was like, I don't think you understand the disease and how complicated it is. You know what I mean? Unfortunately, I hope it's a one and done, and that's my goal, and that's what I'm shooting for. But to put all that pressure on me, you know what I mean? Like, I remember this one time when I was working, and I go to this guy's house, and I'm getting ready to bring his son into it, and he says, I don't care how much money it cost, bring me back my son. And I said, sir, I wish it worked that way. And you know what? There's some other businesses out there that will take your money and not be able to fulfill that promise. I go, but that's not how this disease works. You know what I mean? I can tell you that we'll put them in the right place. We'll give them the right tools. We'll be compassionate. We'll be empathetic. We'll be loving. And we'll be able to keep him safe. But that's, we don't fix him. He's got to do it himself. He's got to find that path, and he's got to find it within him to want this. And if he doesn't, no amount of money is going to change it. That's not how it works.
I'm trying to think an answer to that question. I think the most, I don't, it's no longer surprising, but the questions or references that I get that maybe annoy me more than any are exactly what you said. The expectation of we're paying you money and you're going to fix this like the guy's going to go to get surgery and the surgeon's
going to... Well, it's a medical model attitude, right?
It is.
That doesn't apply. Psychologists are as guilty as anyone for allowing the medical model for treatment to come into mental health, and I include addiction recovery in that, meaning... It works for the med. There's nothing wrong with the medical model in medicine. If you have an infection, you come in, you point it out to the doc goes, okay, yeah, I got something for you here, and they give it to you, and you know, they shoot you up or give you a pill, and it clears up your infection. You're fairly passive in the process, correct, right? So that's a medical model. If you're getting a surgery, a close friend of ours just had a tumor removed. All they had to do is lie there, right? And the team did the rest. You can't be passive in mental health treatment. You have to own your part of it. You want to be with talented people that have all the resources. And for recovery, I think you need a team. You need people with different skill sets and specialties. But it is an active role that the patient or client plays, not a passive role.
And that active role is, because it's a family, typically affects the entire family, the family needs to learn new roles and be active in that. Let me try something on you, okay. Casey. How many kids do you have? Two?
Three.
Three girls?
Two girls, one boy.
Okay. How old are they?
19, 16, and 13.
Okay, let's take 13-year-old. Boy or girl?
Boy.
What's his name?
Bowden.
Would you give Bowden heroin?
No.
Why?
Well, I mean, because it's not good.
Okay. True, but that's not really why. Keep digging deeper. Why won't you give... what's his name?
Bowden.
Bowden.
Why won't I give him heroin?
Yeah.
Because it will kill him.
That's true, too. And I believe you believe it, but why? Why do you want to kill him?
Why don't I want to kill? Because I love him.
There. And here's what I'm uncovering in the last few years that is really powerful to me, is the second we can get our people who are wanting a different way of living, who don't want to blow up their lives anymore by self-medicating with mood and mind-altering substances, the second they can come to this place where they can look themselves in the mirror and say, I love you, it's over.
Yeah.
Because you will never give Bowden heroin because, yeah, it's bad and it's going to hurt and possibly kill him. But at the core, you're not giving it to him. Why?
Because I love him.
When I can look myself in the mirror and say, I'm not putting poison in my body anymore because I love me. The game is over. Now we can go meet with psychotherapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, and start really getting to the core of what was hurting so bad and still hurts and begin making resolution with it.
Oh, I love it. That was some good therapy. Well done. I'm serious.
That was amazing.
How much insight do you have now about that?
I got chills.
Yeah, I can tell. You made this the guy who's never at loss for words lost for words.
What? What is it? What am I missing here? And it's no, because I love him, man. Yeah. And I wouldn't do that to somebody I love.
And we have the hardest time. You don't have any trouble. I know you loving Bowden that much. But we all struggle sometimes loving ourselves that much.
I asked a group just the other night. I was just doing a little, what do they call it, psych ed group. There's a lot of folks in there. And I asked the question, I was with Todd Sylvester and Casey's listening.
Yeah.
I was with Todd and we asked the question, what, on a percentage of 0 to 100, as a human being, what percentage do you value you at right now? And so we went one by one. And, you know, the first couple were, 40. As a human being, my value is 40%. We've got somebody as high as 70 and comes to a female client there, and she quickly said 100. which, by the way, is the correct answer, right? Going along this lines of love. Our value, even that addict struggling in the trenches living under the viaduct right now, their value as a human being does not change. And so I'm really coming to this place where find a treatment program that will incorporate all the evidence-based best practices to deal with the underlying issues, the trauma, the thinking errors, belief systems, but incorporate in that some method of helping people understand our value never changed. As a human being, our value never changed. We put this label on it that we are not valuable, which was hogwash, it's thinking error, and then incorporate that with I'm going to learn, figure out to live my life so that I can look that person in the mirror and say, I love that person now. And then the game's over.
Well, I think that's an amazing place.
How do we get the public to feel that way about the people living under the viaducts? Because I agree with you 100%. Another general science principle is Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is usually the most correct. And that's a simple and very correct explanation. We no matter who we are, our values 100% as human beings. How do we get the public?
Well, it goes back to, you know, what they say in the recovery, you know, love the addict, hate the disease. But sometimes that water gets so murky that you can't differentiate. You know what I mean? But the reality is we need to, because the person you love is still there. The person that was your baby boy or your baby girl or your husband or your father or whatever, that person is still in there, but the disease has clouded you and given you the judgment.
Right.
And you know what I mean? And then you've only got two answers there. You know what I mean? If there was more understanding of what was going on, then I think we could get there easier.
Yeah, I like that.
I do think that lends itself to those of you listening that are in that place where you're so angry, rightfully so, with your loved one, or you need your own therapy.
Sure.
You ought to be going out there and finding your own individual therapist.
Al-Anon.
To work, whatever, Al-Anon's wonderful for that. Work on that, because that judgment,
well,
I love
because
it.
You're dealing with trauma, right? If we love somebody that much and they're in the depths of their addiction, that's traumatic for us because of that loving bond we have with them. We do need help and support.
It's not just their problem. It's our problem.
Right.
You know, we had Lizzie Dankers on, who runs Action Recovery up there in South Ogden. And, she was talking about when she started to get into the world of recovery. And a therapist told her and her husband, says, either you guys do this together or you'll end up apart. Because she's going to grow and move, and you're going to stay where you are, and that's not going to be good for your relationship. So this guy who never had an addiction problem, wonderful guy, you know, went okay and started going to therapy and started doing it, and now they're killing life, you know, and just doing wonderful things. But you're right. There's so many times, like I remember, like. And once again, I'm throwing my family under the bus, but like right out, it was like, hey, my third. So we were in a family group up in recovery, and my older brother comes and my mom, and the guy stands up and goes, hey, you know, your family members in here working on themselves, and this would be a good time for you guys to work on you as well. And my other brother goes like, I ain't got a problem.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm like, okay. Yeah.
That's the mentality.
He was like, I'm not in here. You are. And yeah. I was like, yeah, but because I'm in here and you're here, we're here. So, I mean, right. but that's one of those things that they don't. They go, a family member's like, well, my son's got a problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, we should change the verbiage on, we've got a problem.
We have a problem.
We've got a problem, yeah.
You know.
I can't how many times people will take their loved one to treatment, drop them off, and almost leave with the words you said early in the program, fix him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We have a problem, Dad. You're smack dab in the middle. You may not cause it. We talked about this probably before. I'm a big believer in the Al-Anon 4 C's. You didn't cause this, Dad, Mom, significant other. You can't cure it. You can't even control it, although you tried. But dadgummit, to a T, y'all contributed to it. So find the role.
That's straight shooting.
He's so good.
So good.
But the 4 C's, one more time. So you didn't cause it.
You didn't cause it. Family member, wife, whatever, you did not cause this.
You can't cure it.
No.
You can't control it, although you did.
Everybody tried to try. Yeah. You all tried to control it.
Hey, but you all contributed.
But in a way, ways they didn't even know.
Sure.
Not deliberate. But without proper treatment and experts from professionals, you're going to repeat those patterns again and too many times the love, you described that pretty good just a minute ago. The addict goes to treatment, comes back great, back into a dynamic of a family that hasn't looked at their own stuff, and we repeat this thing over and over, maybe seven times.
Don't you think that's fear? I interpret a lot of that as fear, like the parent that drops him off and says, fix him, or, you know, the brother who says, I don't have a problem. I think one of the most powerful motivating experiences we have in life is fear. And we don't always understand how it affects us. But it's fearful to look inside yourself. We can do a lot of hard work outside of ourselves. We can be confident in things we do and relationships we create. But when it comes time to kind of look inside and maybe realize, I love this child of mine that I'm dropping off, but I'm afraid I contributed to it. So my fear makes me shove that knowledge and insight away and just say, you fix him. And so I think by changing the narrative and the verbiage, by helping us understand this is a family disease, that we all can help each other, going back to what we wanted in the first place when we started families, I think that can help us overcome some of that fear, because defensiveness is just the armor of fear, right? That's all it is.
Well, I had a fun time today listening to you guys swap stories.
Me too. I'd like Christian to come every time.
I think we should have him back once a quarter.
Yeah, definitely.
You know what I mean? And just talk shop. Because
we got to find out. I'm not going to give it away now, but we gave off-air golf, psychological golf advice. He's got to come back and tell us how that's going.
I'd like to report those outcomes.
Yes.
I will.
And I'm going to see what I can do about my problem.
Plus, he also proved the Beatles right today.
Wow. All you need is love?
That's right.
I got you, buddy.
Right? He's deep.
Yeah. All you need is love. Da, 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 da. Thank you for listening to another episode of Project Recovery. And Project Recovery is brought to you by Reprieve Recovery up there in Morgan, Utah, an all-women's facility. For more information about them and all the things that they're doing in the world of recovery, check them out at ReprieveRC.com. And in case you forgot, Project Recovery is what, Dr. Matt?
It's a KSL podcast.
Da, 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 da. All you need is love.
Love.
Love. Love is all you need.
10 of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.